This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Today, we're all looking for ways to save. That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance and monitors your medical claims as they come in, then flags any hidden errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Texas Republican Michael McCaul says, I think Russian propaganda has made its way into the United States. No, really. And unfortunately, it's infected a good chunk of my party's base. Oh, you don't say. We have a fascinating show for you today. Talking Feds, Harry Lipman tells us about the stakes of Judge Aileen Cannon's latest insane ruling. Then we'll talk to Inside Elections' Jacob Rubashkin about some of these very exciting House races. But first, we have the host of The Time of Monsters, the nation's G-tier. Welcome back to Fast Politics, the nation's, my friend, G-tier.
Always great to be on the show, Molly.
So I want to talk to you about something that got no coverage, but that I know happened because I watch C-SPAN and I'm a total nerd. Yesterday, Bernie Sanders, you'll remember Bernie Sanders because he was really probably very likely could have been president, whatever, we're not going to relitigate 2016, but we'll just say this. Bernie Sanders has become, and of course it gets no media attention because there's no drama, one of the great champions of Joe Biden. And yesterday he was at the White House talking about how drug prices, I mean, this was like, I was listening to this and I was like, holy shit, this is the thing that I've been obsessed with forever, that an inhaler will cost $600 in America and $10 in Germany. That, you know, an asthma medicine will cost $700 in America and $2 in the UK. Joe Biden has really satiated a lot of the stuff Bernie Sanders has been trying to get passed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing about Joe Biden is he's really, on almost all issues, a party man, and then he will go where the party is. And I think that he, more than a lot of mainstream Democrats, saw, you know, like, how far Bernie got in 2016. And to be fair, even like in 2020, where he did less well in a more crowded field, but still he was like, you know, the number two guy. And so, I mean, I think Biden realizes that, you know, to have a functioning party, you have to like include, you know, the first is like the second most popular person, like two times in a row. The drug prices is a great example of this. I mean, I think there's other stuff like in sort of build back better, the sort of infrastructure spending. It's such a no-brainer, and it's such a way to draw contrasts between the Democrats and the Republicans and between Biden and Trump, particularly since, you know, like, I think actually one weakness of Trump is that he can no longer really own the economic populism in a way that he kind of did with, like, Hillary Clinton in 2016. We're not seeing, like, you know, on sort of like trade issues or other issues, Biden ceding that ground. And furthermore, I mean, I think the great thing is, like, Trump barely talks about this stuff. I mean, he does kind of talk about trade, but, like, in a much more grandiose and, I think, frightening to a lot of people, like, you know, to say, you know, like,
100% tariff.
Well, whereas, you know, like, I actually think, like, in 2016, like, you know, the moment I got terrified was when the speeches he was making in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, where, you know, like, often he's undisciplined, but, like, when he was there, I don't know if Steve Bannon or somebody else was, like, really, you know, like, whispering in his ears, but he really hit the economic populism thing hard about, you know, like, deindustrialization and job losses. But I actually think, like, you know, Democrats have regained that territory. And yeah, I mean, Bernie deserves a lot of credit. And, you know, like, I want to be fair, like, Biden deserves a lot of credit here, too.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I don't think it matters. Like, Bernie did come in and he was really involved in the budget stuff and in the Inflation Reduction Act, which, by the way, reduced inflation, right? Like, government spending works. I mean, that's the crazy thing. We've seen, like, in 2008 during the financial crisis, we now know that the reason that it fucked up was because we didn't go big enough, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. And I want to say something else on the inflation front, because it ties in with this economic populism and the way Biden has absorbed a lot of this stuff. I mean, there is a kind of debate among economists at a very high level, you know, like, what was the cause of this recent spurt of inflation? Basically, people like Larry Summers have a sort of monetarist view, like, the spending that caused the inflation and the only cure of this is to, like, radically raise interest rates. And then, like, Larry Summers had actually said, you know, you need, like, 7.5% unemployment or maybe 10% unemployment. That's the only cure, right? Whereas there are other economists like Isabella Weber who made the quite rational, like, argument, like, we're talking about inflation, like, what actually happened here? There was, like, you know, like, a pandemic. There were, like, and these shortages of goods. And then companies were able to exploit this to do sort of price gouging. And that if you address that issue, you can have a better take on this. And one notices that, like, Biden, he's talking about, you know, things like shrinkflation, but also, like, corporate profiteering, you know,
yeah,
like, hitting the notes.
And,
this was not a natural thing for Biden, by the way. I mean, I think he was actually initially there, the White House was reluctant to go this path. But all the polls show, like, if you actually talk about inflation in those terms, that, like this is not, like, you know, just some act of God or some cause of, like, simply monetary policy, that they're actually people who have taken advantage of the chaos caused by COVID and that we will go after them. That resonates with the experience of a lot of people. I mean, people actually experience this when they go shopping for groceries and they suddenly notice that, like, the cereal box is, like, half empty. Like, there's something, you know, cereal, same or higher price with a half empty box.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually think it's kind of really great. And one of the things I've really been struck by in Biden world, which I like and appreciate, and I hope to see more of, is them being pressured into doing the right thing. Sometimes they do the wrong thing, and the activist side is able to sort of get them to do what needs to happen, what the right thing to happen there is. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The question is, like, when you're talking about politics, like, what sort of theory of change do you have? And I think that, like, you know, for me, it's always been that there's two sort of preconditions for, like, sort of, you know, progressive politics in the last century. Like, let's not talk about the 19th century where, you know, you had the Republican, you actually had good Republicans like Lincoln and Ulysses Grant. But in the 20th and 21st century, what you need to actually have progress are two things. One is the Democrats political party having power, like the presidency, Congress. The second precondition, though, is that you need a mass movement that is actually prodding them to, like, do something. Because, to be honest, like, I think, like, you know, like, natural condition of a lot of politicians is, you know, like, you get away with as little as you can. Like, if you can make people happy by declaring, you know, well, this is National Pinecone Day, And don't we all love pine cones? Like, they'll do that, right? Like, they could do that all day long, every day, 365 days a year, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like hug your dog day. Sure. Right. But if you actually have, you know, people out on the streets, like the unions were in the 30s, or like the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement were in the 60s, or ACT UP was in the 1990s, and you don't have Republicans who will just not listen to people, you actually have Democrats who know that, well, these are actually our voters, then you can actually prod and change things. So my theory of change has always been, you need those two things, both of them. And I think the fallacy that people fall into is like seeing only one side of the equation. Well, we just need to, like, you know, vote blue no matter who, you know, then we'll be all fine. Or, you know, conversely, you know, like, we just need to kind of protest. Well, no, actually, you actually have to, like, vote the people who are going to listen to you into office, and then you protest.
One of these sort of interesting moments here that we saw is that there's a real sea change in Democratic leaders from Bill Clinton, who got in there. Like, I'm struck by, you have a Republican base that is just controls, drives the fucking ship, right? They want no abortion. They want no birth control pills. They want no anything. They want no fault divorces. And Republicans are like, yes. And then you have a Democratic base that wants, like, clean air. You know, maybe Exxon shouldn't be, you know, controlling our federal government. We don't think kids should get cancer from dirty air. And you know what I mean? Like, these are not wildly progressive ideas. And there's still quite a bit of pushback in the Democratic Party. And I think that Biden world has been much better about that.
Biden has been better about that. I mean, I think this is sort of like, it's a change that's taken a long time to get together. And, you know, like, not to speak ill of the dead, but I think an emblematic figure who I will speak ill of is Joe Lieberman, you know, who was, like, remember the sort of, you know, Democratic vice presidential, like, nominee in the year 2000. And who, like, you know, ran with Al Gore and was seen as, like, well, this is the guy we need to win over the moderate votes. But, you know, was a major Democrat, but his major achievements were always, like, you know, to go against the base of his party, to the point where, like, you know, like, he got primaried out, where the, you know, like, the Democratic voters of Connecticut said no, and then he ran as an independent. I think the easing out of figures like Joe Lieberman is a kind of a significant factor. I mean, there's still, you always get a few senators who like to showboat by doing that. But I think that particular type of politics doesn't have a future. And once he's actually also with the sort of, like, cinema, like, I think, like, you know, the fact that she is going to be, like, a, you know, one-term senator is not an accident. Like, you cannot get very far with that sort of politics anymore. And I think Joe Biden, you know, like, he's been around for a long time, but partially he's been around for a long time because he knows which way the wind is shifting. And he knows what the party is and where the party is going. So, yeah, I mean, I think he does kind of deserve credit. And I think he understands that old sort of triangulation model does not work anymore.
Yeah. And one of the things about Joe Biden, which I actually really do appreciate, is Biden world has actually been really good at working within the kind of weird metrics of what the American system is right now. Like, what I'm thinking of that I think was a real three-dimensional chess move was this border bill, because that border bill. So, you know, we've had in America, we've had zero border legislation since for about 20 years. So there's no money going to the border and no legislation. So surprisingly, it's not going great. And everyone who is there on the left, on the right, agrees they need money. They need money for judges and agents and care for people and, you know, everything from food to enforcement. Both sides agree that when you starve a part of the federal government, it really sucks. I mean, Republicans want it to suck and Democrats don't, but they agree on that central premise. You know, what Biden world did was they were like, okay, you guys are going to negotiate this border bill, which, had it passed, it is a very restrictive bill, right? It involved border closures. By the way, border closures, one of the dumbest Republican ideas. You know how many people go across the border? Republicans, for dinner, for shopping, for vacations. I mean, like, anyway, it would have involved border shutdowns. It would have involved very stringent numbers. It would have, you know, limited immigration in a million different ways. And you had Mike Johnson saying it was dead on arrival. I mean, was Biden world playing three-dimensional chess, or did they just get lucky?
Well, I mean, I do think that they have a pretty good sense of how dysfunctional the Republicans are now. they can shoot themselves in the foot. But coming out of the border thing, like, I think, like, it really was a sort of clarifying moment, especially like this particular Republican Congress, where both the margins are small, but also like Johnson is perhaps the most incompetent party leader like I've ever seen in my lifetime. He's the anti-Nancy Pelosi, and that they're beholden to extremists and they don't know how to control that. And I mean, the big picture is Biden has not been where one would I wanted him to be, like in the polls, but things are tightening now and things are improving. And I think it's partially this clarification issue where, like, you know, like if you actually see how incompetent and extremist the Republicans are, then I think Biden's virtues shining forth. And they are virtues of sort of like, you know, actual governance, actual policies. You know, like he maybe does the sort of, you know, I'm trying to be bipartisan more than I would like. But actually, right, because the Republicans are so incompetent, like it actually has worked out this time to actually like show how extreme and bad they are. So agree that the, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, very positive developments.
Yeah. And it is this sort of interesting world where you're really on a knife's edge. One of the things that we're going to watch this week is whether Mike Johnson can keep his job. Marjorie Taylor Greene is getting increasingly insane and mad at him, called him a Democrat. One of the things that really annoyed the fuck out of me, to be honest, is that I was reading some reporting about it, and the reporter, a mainstream political reporter, was saying, well, Democrats should watch out because they could get someone more conservative than Mike Johnson. No, eventually this Republican Party will get more conservative than Mike Johnson. But I mean, don't you think Mike Johnson, I mean,
he's a pretty conservative guy.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, this guy's a no holds barred theocrat. Like, you know, we want to control. What is that? I always forget the number of mountains. Is it like 5 mountains, right, 6 mountains, whatever? Like,
yeah, 7 like, mountains. It's some yeah, crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That sounds like a theme park you take your kids to. Like, we're going to 7 mountains this weekend. By all evidence, just a very extreme theocrat and, you know, like hardline conservative all along the way. But the media is still stuck with this idea, you know, it's up to the Democrats to create a good Republican Party. But I mean, I think Democrats as a whole have moved on from that. And there has been a shift. I mean, it is interesting. I think it's also like how Biden conceives of the presidency is different. Like, I think that both Clinton and Obama saw themselves as trying to be this independent force of the party that can, you know, negotiate between Democrats and Republicans. Whereas I think Biden has more parliamentary sense. Like, I am the leader of this party and I represent the interests of this party when I'm negotiating with Republicans. And I think that is a sort of significant shift. I mean, I think that is the model one wants for Democratic presidents going into the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. Jeed here. I hope you'll come back.
You can't keep me away.
When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. Vanta automates compliance for ISO 27001 SOC 2 and more, saving you time and money. Unify your security program management and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, FlowHealth, and Cora use Vanta to build trust and improve security in real time. Access Vanta's free suite of resources to scale your governance, risk, and compliance program at vanta.com/special. That's vanta.com/special.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Spring is here, and I bet you are trying to look fashionable. So why not pick up some fashionable, all-new Fast Politics merchandise? We just opened a new store with all new designs just for you. Get t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and tote bags. To grab some, head to fastpolitics.com. Harry Lipman is a former U.S. attorney and host of the podcast Talking Feds. Welcome back you to my podcast, me to your podcast. Hi, Harry Lipman.
Hey, 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 Molly Young Fast. It is another Molly mashup, the special correspondent extraordinaire for Vanity Fair, the host of the podcast Fast Politics. So, yes, we're having an unholy marriage here between Fast Politics and Talking Feds. And you know the rules now. She'll throw something at me, baby. Totally candid. And then I get to turn the tables on her. So why don't start with your nerdiest, pointy-headedest little legal question and see if you can stump me. I'm ready.
This is not my nerdiest question, but this is the thing that everybody's interested in. It seems as if things have escalated with Judge Cannon and Jack Smith, right? That there's was sort of a back and forth, and now Jack Smith is kind of like, he kind of gets what a bad faith actor she is. Talk to me about where you think this case is, and more importantly, where it can go.
Yeah. So you're 100% right. This was the big move Monday night. Remember, what has she been doing? Entertaining all kinds of forgotten ideas from Trump, but also, even worse, delaying, not ruling, and the like. And that put the DOJ in a tricky position because they have a previous bad ruling by her, and if you combine it with another, that'd be a case to recuse. But she doesn't give them anything and purposely doesn't give them anything to grab onto as a ruling. This latest thing is a perfect example. 100% bizarre idea. Let's just talk about jury instructions based on law that doesn't exist. Let's just talk about it, though. Engage with.
Right. The theoretical. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's have a little salon about this. And, you know, that's not a ruling to try to reverse. And there have been different versions of this. And this time it got even more ominous because she suggested, maybe I'll just do this at trial and the jury stage. And guess what? At trial, if she pulls this crap at trial, you can't, it's double jeopardy and you can't retry him. So that's like the perfect crime. I think people sort of sense the tone of it, but it's stronger than people are appreciating. He really drew the line this time. First, he came out and said, this whole Presidential Records Act, it is completely ludicrous. I'm not going to play ball with you, Judge. I'm not going to do a little jury instruction based on it because it's totally nuts. But guess what? Here's the real jury instructions. And now you, Judge, have to rule. So you've been sort of dithering around. And if you don't, so, you know, right now he's there with like nothing to sort of grab onto. And so the move he made is rule on the Presidential Records Act. If you rule for Trump, great. We take you right up to the 11th Circuit and we try to recuse you. Rule for us? Okay, good. Move to another day. But if you keep not ruling, the M word comes into play. And it was just subtle at the end. We are going to mandamus you. It's a special writ. It is hard normally to bring.
And explain what it means.
It's a sort of all-purpose, just like mandate.
It's getting a judge kicked off a case.
Well, there's a separate thing that is recusing. But mandamus is just going to a court of appeals and saying, just correct her. Courts of appeals aren't normally very receptive to it. But he's really set the table perfectly, and they know what's going on, to say, if you don't rule, we're going to do a mandamus. And they found a couple cases where it had happened. So it could be a game changer for a couple reasons. One, she could see the writing on the wall and actually rule. Not too likely. Or she could keep farting around. They could bring a motion to mandamus. If the 11th Circuit is receptive, they bounce her. And now a lot of time has passed. You know, it's not so easy, but there's the actual chance. This case is really cut and dried, Molly. It's been the easiest one and a serious one. And there's a chance with a new judge, it could actually get back on track and be heard, say, in the summer, lead to a conviction and the like. But Smith is, this is the filing. It's the most important since the indictment, where Smith is saying, we're not going to take it anymore. If you don't act like a real judge and decide things, we're going to use that very fact of not giving us anything to appeal. To appeal. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. All right.
Wow.
Big day. My turn.
Satisfied. Yes.
Okay. You recently wrote one of your really both. I mean, you have a way of saying, this is not supposed to be a spoosh fest, but you're just really good at making things fun, interesting, but also trenchant.
Oh, thank you.
In your recent piece, Trump's Losing Touch, you say the road to Democrats having kept the Senate thus far is lined with Trump's bungled attempts to play kingmaker. Now, you know, in the last several years, his whole interim effect, as I've understood it, with Republicans who mainly behind the scenes hate his guts, have been there terrified that he could primary them. And that's his whole secret power. And now you're talking about a run of times where he is trying to do the same and he's losing again and again. Has he lost his magic powers here?
So one of the interesting things about Trump is that he's never been amazing at picking candidates. And part of that is because he's open to candidates. Like, one of the things that Trump did was he took over the Republican Party, right? He bullied people either with the threat of primary or with the threat of their physical safety. I mean, think about Mitt Romney had to pay all that money for extra security. And he took over. And what happened then, he became the de facto leader of the Republican Party. And one of the things, like, you could criticize Nancy Pelosi, right? You could say she isn't lefty enough, she's this, she's that. But at the end of the day, Nancy Pelosi was very organized, right? So you wouldn't see votes come up that would fail in Rules Committee. And another thing she was really careful about was she wouldn't make her purple district Dems, who had to be up for re-election in a year or even less, she wouldn't make them vote on things she knew could be used against them in election. Now, fast forward to this Republican Party, where you have blue state Republicans, you have a bunch, right, in New York and California, people like Mike Lawler. I mean, like, Mike Lawler goes on MSNBC and says he's a sane Republican, but he's had to vote for both impeachments, right? He voted to impeach a cabinet official. The first time in more than 100 years that's happened. You know, there were no high crimes and misdemeanors. They just didn't like him. And he voted to impeach Joe Biden. And again, that was a completely vibes-based impeachment.
Or he voted to keep the investigation going, right?
Right. To open the impeachment.
To open. That's what I mean. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So what you have with Trumpism is there's nobody driving the ship, right? He's in charge, but he's not really driving the ship. So when you have these candidates, nobody is saying, like, this is not a good candidate for swing voters. This candidate is an extremist candidate. And I think one of the original sins of Trumpism, one of the things that ultimately I think very likely will be his undoing, though I don't want to predict the future, is that he went way more right wing and let the party kind of control him, right? He sort of embraced the basest aspect of the party, which is not what you do, right? Usually you get elected and you try to pivot to the middle so that you can get the Democrats, so you can grow the electorate, right? And so what he never learned the lesson that you don't want to nominate the most extreme person for as a candidate because voters don't like it. In ruby red states, he was able to win with these candidates, though often they've delivered results that were below what the polling average would be, right? But he would get these people elected, but his swing candidates always, always, always failed because they were just too extreme.
Oh, this is dating back. I see. This is a new phenomenon.
From Roy Moore, right?
Right.
In Alabama. I mean, the man turned an Alabama Senate seat blue. He has never been a good candidate picker. Like, the one time he ever picked anyone who was a winner was Mike Pence, who helped him win. But otherwise, everyone else has just been a disaster. And, you know, a lot of times he's just endorsed people to get his numbers to be better. He's endorsed, like, people who were running for re-election. But ultimately, he's a very bad candidate picker. And, you know, why shouldn't he be? You know, he doesn't have any, you know, he's only been in politics since 2015.
And, I mean, he just picks based on petty, personal things, not any kind of political calculation.
If you suck up to him, he likes you.
Yeah, there you go.
It's an easy calculus. Yeah.
Okay, your turn.
So the Supreme Court right now is looking at this idea of presidential immunity, which is, as we all know, completely silly and not conceal Team Six murder your political opponent. Yes, because crimes aren't crimes if you're president. There is no world in which any of this flies. So why is it taking so long? Obviously, Alito and Thomas are all in on this. But what do you think the timetable is on this? Are they going to try to keep it going till June? What do you think this happens? And also, like, people like who are trying to pretend to be real justices, like Justice Kavanaugh Kegstand, I mean, he must be pretty pissed too, in a certain way. So let's talk it through with me.
Great question. You're right. There is no world in which Donald Trump, at the end of the day, gets a ruling from the Supreme Court or any court that says he's out of jail free because his actions are covered by presidential immunity.
Right. It's not how any of this works, right?
There's no world where that happens. But of course, Trump always operates on two levels, a delay level, maybe the most important, and then the merit. He will not win the merits, but delay is everything,
right,
especially for him. This is a federal case, and I think all your listeners know this, but all that has to happen if he wins, he just tells the DOJ, oh, that little prosecution, drop it. So the thing about immunity that from day one has always been so worrisome is it's a right not to stand trial in the first place. And as a result, when a trial court rules against you, you can make an immediate appeal. Almost everything else, you have to go to trial, be convicted, go through it, and then make all your claims. But immunity is special. Okay, so we've known that, and he played his card on immunity and got a pretty good delay out of Chutkin, but a really excellent opinion by the D.C. Circuit. It might have been the end of it there. And yes, so now here comes the U.S. Supreme Court. They took 2 weeks to decide. So some shit was going on there, and that we'll eventually find that out. But the big question is, here's the concrete risk, and it's not small to me, Molly, that they decide they have to look out for not just the case, but the principle that they set down. Let's say they think, all right, you know, Trump, of course, but there could be a situation, a president bombs Cambodia and, you know, he gets sued criminally. There could be a situation where we want to hold that the Constitution prohibits the criminal charges against the president. All they have to do is enunciate some test like that. And what happens is it goes back for a remand. Judge Chutkin takes an hour and a half to say it doesn't apply to Trump. But then Trump gets a shorter, but another trip up and down.
Oh, wow. Could that really happen?
100%. That's a risk that I think is more than 50%. So now let's talk about the court. They can do things quickly. Remember, they just, in the Colorado case, the insurrection case, they made a point of issuing the opinion on the Monday before Super Tuesday so people would know.
Right.
You might have thought that they here would do the same thing because we really want to have a trial, even if you're pro-Trump, the value to the American people of having a trial so people know the results when they go to the polls. As best I can tell, that factor matters to the court zero. I think the court has decided that's not our lookout. We're going to take our, you know, regular time. They could have made the argument earlier. Instead, they put it on the last day of the term where there was one slot. You got to imagine there's more than one opinion. So in other words, the earliest this comes out is like early June. And then, okay, if it comes out early June and it's just affirming totally the D.C. Circuit, now Chutkan's back in business. But if it comes out early June and it states any test where sometimes a president can be immune, now we have the extra little road trip for Trump of back down and back up. And man, it looks very remote.
And that waits till September?
I think even without that little extra trip, it's sort of September. So it might just blow it out of the water. Let's say it is September by the time, because remember, when it goes back to Chutkan, he's still got to write this Trump to raise some things.
Right.
So now it's September. Wow. So this most serious of all trials with him having to be in the seat in the home stretch, he's going to say to the Supreme Court, you've got to not let that. But we should have such problems because that is right now the best case scenario. And a likely one I'm really afraid of is there's another round of a remand and September doesn't even happen. Okay. Oh, we're on time. If we go quick, my turn. Florida, which I grew up with always thinking Florida, the crazy place that decides elections. And so when this week the Florida Supreme Court out of the blue, on the one hand, kind of paves the way for a 6-week ban. They just say it's the 18-week, so it could be 6 weeks. But on the other, green light that initiative, which is a pro-choice initiative. So there's going to be such focus. And over the last two cycles, the issue is always played to the Democrats' advantage, but Florida is not your 2000 Florida, which is on a knife's edge. Florida is more red than that. So do you see any state of affairs in which the whole abortion thing actually puts in play in terms of winning or losing in the presidential election, the great state of Florida?
I'm going to add something to your question, which is one of the things that this Supreme Court did was they said that now the 6-week abortion ban can go into action. And that is, I think, actually a really important data point because Florida has always been a state with pretty lax abortion laws for the South. And the people of Florida have never had the experience of being really a place where you can't get an abortion. So now you have Florida OBGYNs who are going to have to practice OBGYN care, maternal fetal health care, as if they're in the state of Louisiana or Texas. And what that's going to mean is going to be a real sea change, because we've already seen this happen in the states that banned abortion. It will be in 30 days more dangerous to be a pregnant woman in Florida than it is in Connecticut or New York or Rhode Island or Vermont. Because if you're a pregnant woman in Florida, your doctor is always thinking, I could go to jail for this. I could lose my license for this. I could be fined $100,000 for this. Maybe Ron DeSantis, who we already know is kind of a loose cannon, wants to make this Miami gynecologist an example. So already you're going to have doctors practicing defensive medicine. And one of the things I would say that I don't think we spend enough time talking about when we talk about choice in reproductive health care is that pregnant women who are not necessarily pro-choice, people who aren't Republicans, who never wanted to get an abortion, who never thought you should have the legal right to get abortions, don't necessarily realize how much their pregnancy care changes now that doctors are worried about getting arrested. From May to November, you're going to see the state of Florida as an abortion desert. So when those voters come to vote on those ballot initiatives, they're going to know really what they're voting for. And I think that is a really important data point. And historically, we have seen that when people experience losing that right, they understand why it's so important. So I do think that'll be a big deal. Will Democrats win Florida? It doesn't matter matter. What matters is Republicans are now worried that Florida might be in play. This changes the map, right?
And the money, right? Money, 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 right? Yeah.
And it's a very expensive media market, Florida. And you've got Trump running defense in a state he thought would be a cakewalk. And remember, Florida is like the first time ever Florida population is going down now, right? People are leaving the state because of inflation, because they have such bad inflationary pressures when it comes to insurance and inflation and the cost of goods and housing. So I actually think it's going to be a real problem. And will a Democrat win Florida? Most pundits would say absolutely not. But again, we don't really know, right? We're basing all of this on polls. Maybe these polls are all totally correct, but there certainly has been a lot of crosstab volatility there.
And that's a really good point. And it's not just, of course, the presidency. There's guys like Rick Scott, et cetera. All right, we're down to 5 minutes, and we've each had two rounds, and Jesse is very strict. I think we only have one question left.
What case is the case that you think might surprise us, some of the Trump cases? Or is there like a sleeper case, like the case with the California bar? I mean, do you think there's a case that might sort of move the needle that we are not even looking out for?
Right. So I'll just say the legal needle and the political needle, because we've had different cases where judges have found he basically is guilty of sin, but not in the criminal context. And what you just named, the Eastman and Jeff Clark disciplinary proceedings have that, including like, it was a really big thing. We got a preview of the what's going to be a killer witness in the January 6th trial, the Ramrod Straight Pat Philbin, Pat Cipollone, White House counsel folks who invoked executive privilege in the January 6th committee, but they won't at trial. So that stuff is going to be killer. They'll also, you know, Hope Hicks, I think, is going to be killer in this upcoming trial. In other words, there are trials that could be sleepers, but I think the real point is most of everything we've heard so far has been argument and people kind of, you know, screaming at each other. But there's going to be these pristine crystalline moments of testimony where, like, what the hell is he going to say about that? I mean, these are witnesses from hell for him. I want you to give me 90 seconds to do a plug. Can I do that?
Yeah, sure.
We just started a new speaker series out here called Talking San Diego. Jamie Raskin was here last week. Jen Psaki is coming. We gonna have really a great slate of speakers. So if you're anywhere in the area, just go to talkingsandiego.net and that'll give you the info and you can buy a ticket for it. There's my self-promotion name.
Yay! Jacob Rubashkin is an analyst and reporter for Inside Elections. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Jacob.
Thanks for having me.
Explain to us what you guys have right now that's new and exciting.
So we just published at the end of last week our quarterly House overview. You know, I think Inside Elections, we're the only ones who do with the kind of depth and regularity, a look at the full House battlefield. We wrote about 110 House races that have either interesting general elections, interesting primaries, special elections, something cool is going on there. We took about 12,000 words, the full issue, to write a little bit about every single House race worth knowing about taking place around the country. And so we put out that issue at the end of last week. And along with that, we included a number of ratings changes. So we assess the likelihood of each party winning every single seat across the nation. And we make adjustments to that as the cycle progresses. And so of those 110 that we wrote about, 12 of them, the circumstances have changed. And so we updated the rating to more accurately reflect where we think those races sit today.
So 110 is a lot of races. Of those 110, sort of exciting, that's about a third, right, of all the races in Congress, right?
Well, a little less than a fourth, yeah.
I was like 400, 300. I write a ton about Congress for someone who's like a general opinion columnist, and I still, you know, I'm like, it's like 375, 400, 450. But what I want to ask you is, so only a fourth are even worth sort of like looking into, right? Because 3/4 of them are people who've either been there for a million years or are just so they're an R plus 27 or something, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think that even of that 110.
Of those 110, how many are competitive?
Competitive in a general election, we currently carry 72 seats on our House battlefield. So that is seats that
we... That's actually higher than I thought.
And it's a little higher. It'll get smaller as we progress through the cycle, but I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And so what we try and do is give ourselves some latitude in both directions, right? We're looking at seats that could be competitive in a good Democratic year, but we're also looking at seats that could be competitive in a good Republican year. And as we get to the summer and certainly to the fall, as the presidential election becomes a little bit more clear, we will know that a lot of those seats are no longer on the battlefield, right? If we're in October, or even if we're in July, right, and the presidential race looks like it's going to be in favor of one candidate or the other, that's going to shift how the presidential battlefield goes. But for now, we've got a lot of seats that could go one way or the other. And then we've got a seat like West Virginia's 2nd District, which is not a competitive general election seat, but it's an open seat. There's going to be a Republican primary and there's going to be a new member of Congress. And even if that's going to be a Republican, like the outgoing member, it's always important when you get a new member of Congress, they come in with their own set of priorities, their own background. And as we've seen over the last year or 6 months, the individual personalities of all of these members can have an outsized impact on how the House functions.
See, you're a straight reporter, so you can't say what I'm thinking, which is you can always get it crazy like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who will hijack the entire party. See, you can't say it, but I can. Just not.
There are differences within each party's conference that can be just as important as whether you're a D or an R. I'll put it that way.
Let's get talking about this. 72 competitive seats. What are the sort of, I'd love to know what are the sort of ones that you were surprised by or that you were like, oh, wow.
So there are a couple that I think have not necessarily gone the way I might have expected at the beginning of the cycle. Kind of in both directions. On the Democratic side, for instance, Nevada, right? In 2022, Nevada was one of the big, big prizes of the House battlefield. I mean, we saw both Democrats and Republicans, super PACs, spend tens of millions of dollars in the Las Vegas media market. There were three congressional districts that were looked at as up for grabs, the first, the third, and the fourth, all held by Democrats. Republicans really wanted to win them, and they spent a ton of money trying to, and they lost all of them narrowly, but they didn't win any of those Nevada seats. And heading into 2024, I think there was an expectation, this is a really competitive presidential year. This is going to be a top state in the Senate battlefield. These House races are going to be front and center again. And in fact, what we've seen is a lot of Republican pessimism about Nevada. They've been unable to recruit top tier candidates. They are not really talking about those races and those Democratic incumbents as top tier pickup opportunities.
That's wild.
And so a state that was so central to the battlefield last time has really become a bit of a backwater, even as that Senate race is super, super interesting. The presidential is super interesting.
And I always think of Nevada as like a worry for Dems.
Yeah.
Like it's in the D column until it's not. I feel like one of the big problems Republicans are having right now is money, that they have a cash crunch. And because Donald Trump's legal fees are so high, it's like a cash crunch for them. You can see it in down ballot races, which that would make the most sense, right?
Yeah, the Republicans have struggled to keep pace with Democrats on the fundraising side. On the candidate side, I'll be specific, because the Republican super PACs generally have more money than their Democratic counterparts. So like the Congressional Leadership Fund, which is the main Republican super PAC, tends to have more money to throw around than the House Majority PAC, which is the analogous institution on the left. But of course, those dollars, they don't go as far because it's you get a better rate for advertising if you're the candidate than if you're a outside super PAC. So it's definitely a factor for Republicans, the money.
So tell me what else you're seeing that's interesting and surprising like that.
There were a few races that we moved in Republicans' favor. I'll point out two of them here. Michigan's 10th district which kind of sits, it's a suburban district right north of Detroit. It has an incumbent Republican congressman named John James. He won a very narrow election in 2022, open seat race. Congressman Andy Levin held this seat for a while. But when Michigan redrew their maps, he chose to run in a Democratic primary against his colleague Haley Stevens.
And he lost.
And lost. Yeah. Now, if he had run in this district, he would have won.
Oh, no. Haley's still running, right?
Yeah. She's running for her seat again. But Andy Levin, there was some thought maybe he would run against John James, but he obviously is not doing that. This is a really marginal district. Trump would have carried it in 2020 by about a percentage point. But if you look at the results of the 2022 elections in Michigan in this seat, they were all quite good for Democrats. Gretchen Whitmer, Jocelyn Benson, and Dana Nessel, who were the three women at the top of the ticket for Democrats in Michigan, all carried this district by double digits. And John James only won by around 2,000 votes.
Isn't John James the guy they keep running for Senate?
Yeah. So he ran for Senate in 2018 and 2020. Yeah.
He's like the one Black Republican.
Yeah, and they actually, I believe there are now more Black Republicans in Congress than ever before.
Right, but it's still like four.
Yeah, I think it's four or five. But yes, he ran for Senate twice, nearly won in 2020, and then barely won this congressional seat. The Democrats look like they're going to nominate a guy named Carl Merlinga, who was the nominee last time. He is a very old school attorney in the area. He was a judge in Macomb County. He was a prosecutor, a defense attorney. He was the nominee last time, but he is not a good fundraiser, and he's got some legal baggage from his time as a judge and a defense attorney, because a lot of defense attorneys take on unsavory clients that Republicans were able to weaponize really effectively last time. And despite the fact that this should be a top-tier pickup opportunity, they were not able to attract a real top-tier challenger for James. And so in all likelihood, Merlinga will be the nominee again. He's not going to have a lot of money. It's going to be a really expensive media market in Detroit because of that Senate race and the presidential. And so this is one that, again, we kind of expected to be a little bit more competitive.
Democrats could flip.
Yeah.
But they don't nominate the right person for it, so they can't. That's Michigan what?
Michigan 10.
I have a question about the ladies who control Michigan, the governor, the AG, yeah, and the Secretary of State. Do they help down ballot candidates in Michigan, or is there no correlation?
In 2022, they pretty clearly did, because when they were on the ballot in Michigan, all three of its statewide offices are up in non-presidential years. So none of them will be on the ballot this time, but clearly, in 2022, the fact that you had three strong candidates at the top of the ticket was a big boon for Democrats running down ballot. Remember, you also had that abortion referendum that passed by a pretty significant margin. That was helpful. And you had Republicans in two of those three races. Republicans nominated candidates that were pretty Trumpy, that were pretty baked in with the, you know, conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. So for Governor Tudor Dixon and for Secretary of State Christina Karamo. And so two out of the three statewide candidates couldn't raise any money and were really unpalatable to a lot of voters. And so that's why you saw Michigan was such a bright spot for Democrats in 2022. In 24, when they're not on the ballot, I don't think it helps nearly as much.
But the Republican Party in Michigan has had some real problems.
Yes.
You want to talk about that?
The Republican Party in Michigan kind of underwent a schism, I guess is the best way to think about it. So Christina Karamo, who was that Secretary of State nominee.
And who's pretty wild.
She is pretty wild. She has a lot of conspiracy theories about, I think she said like Beyonce was demonic. Like she's kind of all over the place. So she was elected the chairwoman of the state party in Michigan a couple years ago in a pretty contentious race, and running against actually the guy who was the nominee for attorney general, who performed the best out of the three statewide Republican candidates last cycle. So she beat him. The party was pretty torn up about it. And I mean, we're talking fist fights on camera at Michigan GOP retreats. It's been really rocky for the last year or so in her tenure, and she was ousted a little while ago, and she claimed that it was illegal and that she was still the rightful chair. For a little while, there were two dueling websites. They had two dueling conventions. But since then, things kind of have settled. A federal judge ruled that she was properly ousted. And Pete Hoekstra, who is a former congressman, is kind of viewed by pretty much everyone now as the chairman of the Republican state party. They're still broke. They still don't have any money. But ultimately, whether or not you have a strong state party is a pretty secondary or tertiary concern when we're talking about federal races, at least.
Right. But turnout is still helped by a good state party.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the races that keep people up at night. Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to stick it out. But Lauren Boebert, right? I mean, there's a little excitement there.
This race has so many twists and turns. Talk about things that didn't end up how we anticipated heading into this cycle. Adam Frisch, who I believe you've had on the show before.
Multiple times, yes.
Took Lauren Boebert to a very, very narrow, the most narrow congressional victory of the 2022 cycle, just a couple hundred votes. He was back for a rematch. He was raising a ton of money. It became very clear that he was going to be a real threat to her in the general election. And then she got a primary challenger as well, who started getting some real backing from some of the more moderate and establishment Colorado Republicans. So she decided to switch districts and run in the 4th district, which is, well, not currently represented by Ken Buck, but up until about 2 weeks ago was represented by Ken Buck. And this is the thing that always really gets me is I remember in 2010 when Ken Buck was the Tea Party darling. He was, you know, nominating him in Colorado was, you know, a sign that the right wing of the Republican Party had really come into the fore. And when he lost that race to Michael Bennett, it was held up kind of in the same conversation as Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell. You know, Republicans nominating unelectable candidates is costing them the Senate. Fast forward a decade and Ken Buck is the voice of reason in the Republican Party and is so fed up with how things have gone that he's calling it quits. So he is not running for re-election. He resigned his seat and on very short notice. And so now you've got a vacant seat, you've got an open Republican primary, and you've got a special election all taking place at the same time. Boebert is trying to win the Republican primary. She's not running in the special election. There are a whole bunch of local elected officials who are also running in the primary. It's gotten pretty nasty.
Who's running in the special?
So the special, and Colorado is weird about this. Colorado doesn't do primaries for special elections.
Yeah.
They have a committee. They call them vacancy committees, which are basically committees of local elected officials and Republican Party officials or Democratic Party officials who meet up and choose the nominees at a convention. So the Republican nominee is a guy named Greg Lopez. He is a former gubernatorial candidate. He was a mayor of a town in the 90s. He was picked as the nominee for the special. He's not running in the regular elections.
The reason Lauren Boebert didn't run in the special was because if you run in the special, you can't run in the general, right?
Well, no. So you can do both. The reason she didn't, I'm of two minds. I think one of the reasons why she didn't is because she was worried she would lose. She wouldn't get the nomination, and that would be embarrassing. The other thing is if she ran in the special and won, she would have to resign her current seat, right? Because you can't hold two seats in Congress at once. She didn't put her name in contention. Lopez did, but he said up front that he was only going to serve till the end of the year if he won. And so he's the Republican nominee. The Democratic nominee is a woman named Trish Caboresi, who is a former speechwriter, currently works for the National Science Foundation, has a bit of a background in Democratic politics. She's a real underdog. This is a very Republican seat. So that race will take place on June 25th on the same ballot as the primary featuring Boebert and a number of other Republicans for the full term.
Oh, wow. For the primary. So this is wild stuff. Please tell me what the most fascinating House race you've seen.
I think the Alaska is super interesting. It's the most Republican state currently held by a Democrat. Democrat Mary Peltola, of course, won that big special election in 2022, beat Sarah Palin. Alaska has a unique system of doing congressional and Senate races. It's a top four instant runoff ranked choice voting election. Nowhere else in the country does their elections like this. And she faces two Republican challengers, the lieutenant governor named Nancy Dahlstrom and a tech entrepreneur named Nick Begich, who is the one Republican in the very Democratic and very prominent Begich family in Alaska. And this should be a seat that Republicans are winning. Democrats have very little business holding a statewide seat in Alaska. But because there are two Republicans in the race and neither of them are getting out, it's looking more likely that they're going to get in each other's way and really allow Peltola to do what she's done for the last 2 years, which is be relentlessly positive. She raised up $1.7 million this quarter. That goes a long way in the Anchorage media market. She has caught a real lucky break because Republicans can't unify behind one candidate ahead of the general election. So I think Alaska politics is fascinating. That's a seat the Democrats absolutely have to hold if they want to maintain the majority or reclaim the majority. But, you know, they're going to have some things break their way over the next couple months for sure.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Bobby Junk Fast, you know, it's kind of weird. It's almost like Donald Trump's a vengeful guy. Where are people getting this from?
Trump says he'll jail his opponents. Members of the House January 6th committee are preparing. Yes, they're ready because if Donald Trump, I am sorry, this is insane. Donald Trump is threatening to jail members of the January 6th committee. Their crime is recognizing his crimes. And in case you're wondering, if Trump gets reelected, your crimes will be doing anything that draws attention to his crimes. So may I suggest that perhaps we should cover this election as the insane fiasco it is and not business as usual. Donald Trump making overtures towards jailing his political opponents and his political opponents trying to prepare for jail is our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.